extra on the song today.
Yeah.
Just having a little chaos here at the last minute. Jared, that belongs to Linda. She's going to need that.
Yeah.
We have a little transition show transition thing. We should never visit with the show host from the previous show because then...
And we become
tardy.
But, and we were on time.
Right.
Yeah.
We've been better. We've been better. The chaos has been kept to a minimum. Oh, but it's back. Alrighty. So let's see. Good news is I printed out what we're doing today, so I don't have to wait for my computer to show up. Oh, I do know my own name, if in fact I could say that properly. My name is Aaron Ryan, just
and
in case
Bill
you didn't
Cundiff,
know that.
And I can always say that.
And
I've said that for a long time.
I have too. That's why I never changed my name. I had to keep it the same. It was too confusing. I tried being someone else for 10 years. It was too hard. And the sponsor this hour is?
Yes. Sponsor this hour is Team Power. Team Power, local John Deere Kubota dealer. And right now you can get some great savings on Kubota and John Deere tractors down 3119 Twin View Boulevard. And go down and see them. Buy a tractor.
Are we talking about their website? Up and running?
Yeah, they got a brand new website, readingtractors.com. Readingtractors.com, and got a lot of deals on there. And if you don't see it on the website, give them a call and ask them, and they'll fix you up. If they don't have it in stock, they can get it for you.
And they're here open Saturdays now through the summer.
Yeah, Saturdays noon to 8 to noon. And
noon to 8, the other way around.
Yeah, noon to 8. Yeah, if you want to go that way, go back in time. But, yeah, Team Power, their phone number is 226-9226. Give them a call. Team Power.
There you have it.
There you are.
And you can find everything about our program, and you can also find our archives that are free of charge to listen to at wethepeopleradio.us. So we do a page for every guest we have on, for every show, and after the show, we link a commercial-free archive to that, and it hangs out there waiting for you. So I know we have lots of people who are busy on Sundays or don't like to be tied down or live outside the listening area, and so they plug in through the archives.
Yeah, we had how many people showed up last week during the week? It was a bunch.
Lots.
Yeah.
Several thousand people. We've got a lot of people listening around the world. So if you're in another part of the universe other than the United States, thanks for listening.
Yeah.
And thanks for telling a friend, because there isn't one country that only has one person listening now. I've been watching to make sure people have friends, so I don't know.
Did you mention sponsorship on the site?
What about it?
You can sponsor the show if you so desire.
If you're just a regular person,
yeah.
You can do that if you like. It's all right in there for you. So, without further screwing around here, our first guest is Richard Sander. And Richard, we're going to be chatting with him. This is a new topic for us, so thank goodness his publicist sent us a list of questions. He must have known we were knuckleheads. So he sent us a nice list of questions, so we'll follow along with that, because this is a topic we know nothing about, so we're all going to learn something. The article that I've posted of his is Moving Toward Integration, The Past and Future of Fair Housing. So let's see about our guest. He's a nationally acclaimed professor of law at UCLA School of Law. He's an economist and co-author of the new book that I just mentioned, Moving Toward Integration. He's a leading legal authority on matters of race, housing, and affirmative action, and a prominent social scientist on issues of inequality. So like I said, we're in uncharted waters. We know nothing about this. He's appeared on major radio and television programs nationwide. And then there's us. The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Economist, The Atlantic, quite a spread there. And others have all written about his work. His previous book, Mismatch, has shown the importance of studying the actual effects of affirmative action policies and reshape the national and legal debate on the issue.
Yeah. Now his bio can have at the top nationally acclaimed radio show, We the People. He's been on that one as well.
I'm sure he'll lead with that. Okay, he'll have more fun here, though. Richard, are you in there?
Yes, I am.
Hello, hi, Richard.
I'll make sure I do that. And, thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're more welcome.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being here.
Well, the good news is you'll have more time here than you will with the other people, and we won't give you the bum's rush at the end.
That's great.
So, shall we start with the questions, or are there things you'd like to tell us? Because we'll just follow along.
Well,
this is a cool topic.
Yeah, you know, there's race is a perennial important issue in America. And we've had a number of big racial controversies over the last few years. And what the book tries to do is dig deeper and say what is fundamentally driving racial inequality in America, and is there anything we can do about that? And the answer we come up with is that yes, housing segregation really underlies almost all the other issues.
Yeah, housing was supposed to solve all the problems, and you mentioned here that in a lot of cases it didn't. It didn't. It helped a lot of things, but there were some things that didn't cure.
Yeah, we've done a number of things that are right, but there has been very little examination of the big picture.
Which hardly ever happens in government programs.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, just to ground this discussion,
sure.
It's useful for me to describe something called the Index of Dissimilarity. And this is a measure sociologists use to say how segregated places are. So the index goes from 0, which represents complete integration, to 100, which is complete apartheid. And in the 1960s, before we passed fair housing laws, the average black-white dissimilarity index in American cities was 92. So it was pretty severe, and really something that no other ethnic group in America had experienced or has experienced since. And in 1968, we passed the Fair Housing Act. It was there had been a number of state and local fair housing laws, but they hadn't really accomplished very much. And the federal law prohibited discrimination based on race, national origin, religion, in the private market. And the Department of Justice pretty vigorously enforced it, not only during the Johnson administration, but actually even more so in the Nixon and Ford administrations. And discrimination fell pretty sharply. About two-thirds of the discrimination in the market in the 60s that we can measure had disappeared by 1980.
Wow, that's pretty
significant.
So that's
pretty dramatic.
Sure.
Yeah, so that really accomplished something. But falling discrimination, it turned out, did not eliminate segregation. If we look at how segregated things were by 1980, most of the big cities that have really large black populations had seen segregation fall down to maybe the high 80s. But there were about a dozen cities where there was pretty substantial drops in segregation down into the low 70s, sometimes even the high 60s. And so we looked at those more closely to try and understand what was driving the differences between the different types of places. And we came up with various mechanisms that actually seem to explain a lot, and I can go more into that later. But the other thing that we found was that where segregation fell, it continued to fall. It sort of was on a self-sustaining integration track. And black outcomes started improving in those areas. Almost anything that you look at, you see that in the cities that get the similarity down to low 70, African Americans start improving on health outcomes and test scores and employment rates, more two-parent families, and so on. So that seems to be the most powerful way of actually changing patterns of inequality.
And does it matter how dense the housing is? I mean, are we talking urban with big giant projects, or are we talking mostly single family, or is it just all of the above?
I'd say it's all the above. In other words, we don't see housing density as being a variable that explains whether integration happens.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, these days, a lot of the integration that's happening is occurring through gentrification. Since the early 90s, many middle-class folks have been moving back into central cities. And that's been accelerated, I think, by the decline in urban crime rates. And that sort of integration seems to be as effective in reducing inequality as suburban integration.
Hmm. Yeah, because they're taking some of those, you know, big, like, factory buildings and turning them into these upscale lofts and that kind of stuff, I know, in some places. Does that actually help?
It does. You know, gentrification is more controversial than other types of integration, and there's a lot of fear in the fair housing community, probably the African-American community, about whether gentrification will just produce massive displacements. But so far, that has not generally been the pattern. There are some places where that's happened, parts of New York City, for example, parts of San Francisco. But usually, gentrification produces integration, and it opens up a lot of jobs. And it has a big impact on one of the most intractable problems, which is that segregation tends to concentrate black poverty. And when you have gentrification, that offsets that. That sort of reduces the concentration and opens up, creates a lot of new urban jobs. So, yeah. And if you think about it, you can't have integration just go in one direction. If you just have African Americans and Hispanics move out of central cities into suburbs, then housing prices in the central city will become depressed. There won't be enough demand for them.
Sure.
So gentrification is an important kind of complement to suburbanization.
Yeah, because it winds up looking like what, Detroit?
Yeah, you don't want things to become vacant and foreclosed.
Sure, it deteriorates to a point where it starts to look like a war zone.
Yeah.
Poor Detroit. I wonder if they'll ever pull it out. We have to take a really quick break, and we'll come right back. Our guest today is Richard Sander. We're talking about his book, Moving Toward Integration, and he is the co-author. So we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you
decide how it does. Well, you're never gonna go through twice. Stay tuned.
And we're back with our guest, Richard Sander. Hey, Richard, I was looking at one of the topics on here, and you kind of touched on it, but it was a pretty long list. It's a clip out of your book that says that your book argues that reducing residential segregation is the best way to reduce racial inequality, which you had said. African-American employment rates, earnings, test scores, family cohesion, and even longevity all improve sharply. That's kind of a... I mean, why did you guys... How'd you come up with all that?
Well, yeah, it's...
Because that's a really comprehensive list.
So there are now about a half dozen different solid studies that have found lower segregation causes a variety of better outcomes. There's been less research on exactly what the causal mechanism is. In other words, what's driving this? So we know the patterns there, but things are sufficiently interrelated that it's hard to disentangle exactly what, how lower segregation does this. But there are three or four kind of plausible theories. One is that if you have more integration, then African Americans have access to better services. They're going to be in, usually they'll be in somewhat better funded schools. There'll be more responsive city governments, so on and so forth. A second is that they're closer to jobs. There's something called the spatial mismatch. And since the 1970s, in a lot of cities, jobs have tended to gravitate away from core areas where a lot of African Americans live.
And is it because this is that, inner city, yeah. or no?
Well, all these statistics that I talk about are looking at metropolitan areas as a whole. So, in other words, if an area like San Diego, which is pretty integrated, has an overall lower index of dissimilarity, that means the metropolitan San Diego area has that lower segregation level.
Okay.
So part of what's happening is that African Americans are closer to employment opportunities. But a pretty big factor seems to be just a change in cultural environment. That if you're living in a more integrated neighborhood, you have more role models who have gone to college, and you have classmates in school who have different study habits. And your family picks up on that, and that starts affecting decisions that are made. It starts affecting what time the kids go to bed, how much television they watch, how much reading parents do to their kids. So lots of different things are influenced by sort of your neighborhood milieu. And, you know, these seem to have a cumulatively powerful effect.
It's interesting because I would think it would be difficult to switch that around in an inner city kind of environment, because those patterns have been there for a long time.
Well, the effects we're talking about, like these mortality effects, this is after an area has been significantly integrated for a generation. And so there's that's time to really influence a lot of...
Sure, you can change a lot of habits. And
so do you find that when you start this integration process into a let's say a predominantly white neighborhood, when you bring in the integration, does it tend to bring in a lot of the negative attributes you find in one nationality? I mean, like, do when you bring
people
in...
Does it have the flip result?
An opposite effect of bringing a lot of the bad stuff with it, you know, the crime, the drugs, the gangs. Does that tend to happen as well?
Well, so there are two different patterns you see. And let me just use Chicago and San Diego as an example, because Chicago is a place that has made very little progress towards integration. There are some integrated spots, but its index is still in the low 80s, whereas San Diego has an index in the 50s. So after fair housing laws are passed, what happens in Chicago is blacks are much more mobile. They're moving into white neighborhoods in much larger numbers. But those movements are almost always into areas that are adjacent to existing black areas. So you have sort of a block-by-block expansion of predominantly black areas. And most of those areas go through racial transition. And where the migration is that large scale and sort of that pervasive, yes, it does. The neighborhood at the end of the day is doesn't resemble the white neighborhood that it was originally. It resembles the predominantly black areas.
Right, so the integration didn't work.
Exactly. So you have more mobility, you have more housing available to blacks, but you're not getting more integration. Whereas in San Diego, you have a much more dispersed pattern of migration. And one of the reasons for that is that San Diego in the 70s and 80s was taking off economically. It was attracting migrants, including African Americans, from around the country. And if you move to a metropolitan area after fair housing laws are passed, and you're black, then you're very likely anywhere in the country to move into what we call an outlying area, an area that's more than a couple miles from existing black concentrations. And those footholds are relatively small at first. So in San Diego, you have a lot of neighborhoods by 1980 that are, say, 5% African-American. But that's enough to change the way people sort of perceive the metropolitan area. Whites start perceiving the black areas as not being really black neighborhoods, but being neighborhoods that are becoming more integrated, and start moving into those areas. Blacks see a whole bunch of outlying areas as plausible areas for them to move. And so you get this incremental process of increasing integration. So you don't have any areas that are kind of going through sudden racial transition. You're seeing much more incremental change, but it's steady change, and it keeps building on itself decade after decade. And in those patterns, we don't see any of the sort of increases in crime or,
right,
or neighborhood deterioration.
Yeah, because I would think that in order for that to be effective and to have true integration, you've got to have the migration patterns going in both directions,
yeah,
or you're going to end up with, in the long run, it's going to look the same as it did in the beginning.
Yeah, ultimately, integration means all races see that neighborhood as a plausible place,
right,
a desirable place to live.
Interesting.
Right.
What about, I'm thinking of like the cultural I don't know, we called them ghettos when I was a kid, not because it was a bad place, it just, I don't know, that was the name of it. But like in the East, you have areas where all the Italians live, all the Irish live, where you have the Puerto Ricans live, and you have restaurants and grocery stores that cater to those
cultures.
Well,
it's like that in San Francisco today.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, you have, so how does that play in, or is this really a an African American and white kind of a thing that's the big dynamic?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. We've always had segregated ethnic groups in America, because we've had this polyglot origin from all over the world.
Sure.
And it wasn't always like people did that to them. They lived there because they all spoke the same language. Again, like grocery stores, restaurants, those things. It was sort of their spot.
Their community, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you were an Italian moving to America in 1910, the logical place for you to go was Little Italy, because that's where you could find people who spoke Italian, who could show you the ropes, who could, give you housing. What's different is there are two things that make it different from what blacks experienced. One is that it never became as intense. The index of dissimilarity for Italian Americans or Jewish Americans or Chinese Americans never really was higher than say the low 70s, which is qualitatively quite different from the 90s, which the blacks experienced. Because if the index of dissimilarity is around 70, that means that you still have a lot of people outside your ethnic group in your neighborhood, and that helps fuel assimilation, which is the other big difference. I mean, Italian Americans, every decade that you can track during the 20th century, you see that folks who arrived in 1910, by 1920, they were more likely to speak English. By 1930, their children were intermarrying with other ethnic groups. They start moving out of the old neighborhoods. So there are levels of segregation which just kind of fall decade after decade. And eventually stabilize. Most ethnic groups in America stabilize around something in the 30s on my 0 to 100 scale. And that's great. An index in the 30s means that there are, you have identifiable neighborhoods, you have ethnic concentration with restaurants and so on, but there's no sort of dysfunction that goes along with that. There's no real social isolation. So for blacks, what was different is that from 1920 to 1970, they had these very, very high levels of segregation. And during most of that period, you had legal restrictions that made it very difficult for them to move into white neighborhoods.
And you also had a lot of incentives for, you had all this, the projects. I don't know what they call that now, but when I was a kid, that's what that was called. When we let's take a really quick break so we don't break up the answer on this, because this part is interesting, and for those of us who live in the rural parts of America, we don't deal with this much, and it's kind of a mystery. I mean, not everyone in the country, you've got a huge part of the country that doesn't live in a major metropolitan area, and we look at this like, why can't they get this?
Why can't the big cities?
So actually, this is good education for a large part of our country. We'll be right back with our guest, Richard Sander. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory and awake in the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the Great Compromise.
Yeah, the Great Compromise. We thought that might lead us into our discussion on how the predominantly black communities wound up with the projects and all those things that
were talking about how other ethnic groups, the Chinese, the Italians, had their communities and still do to a certain extent, but were able to integrate into other communities.
They moved out.
They moved out into other communities where the black community, who were basically already here, stayed in their own communities and never really were able to integrate into the other communities. And I think a lot of people wonder why that was. And I think a lot of it was...
crappy policy trapped them there.
Is that it?
Tell us, Richard.
Is that it? Is it policy? Is it government policy that did that?
Well, you know, until the beginning of the 20th century, the black population was almost entirely rural, and almost entirely in the South. And that was was the legacy of slavery and the plantations and so
sure.
on. And the Great Migration started around World War I. And between 1915 and the late 60s, about 5 million African Americans moved from the rural South to cities, mostly in the North. And around 1919 and 1920, there was a wave of rioting in the North, all focused on black-white conflict. Whites were angry because blacks were a much more identifiable minority group. They were, you know, racism was common then. Blacks were seen as inferior by a lot of people. They were often brought in by northern manufacturers to break strikes by white workers. So there was a lot of racial animosity, and segregation, I think, was seen by both government and private groups as a solution to racial conflict. And it was a much easier sell to advance that in the 1920s. So you had mostly private policies, but with a lot of government cooperation that really created ghettos and surrounded many of those areas with restrictive covenants, which were private agreements where a whole neighborhood of white owners would agree not to sell to African Americans. And once that existed, and once you had these really intense levels of segregation, then there was a whole new level of fear based on, well, what happens if blacks start moving out of these areas? Then my neighborhood will be overwhelmed. As we saw, you know, eventually did happen when fair housing laws were passed in some cities.
When was the passage of the fair housing, like 50 years ago-ish?
68, yep.
Okay.
So between the 20s and the 60s, that was the era when a lot of the big housing projects were built. And if they, you know, those projects were pretty much racially designated when they were constructed. They were black housing projects and white housing projects. So you had many things that reinforced this pattern. And once you had that really strong pattern, then getting out of it was a big challenge. As we saw, when fair housing laws passed, some places like San Diego sort of had a combination of things that let those ghettos break down more or less spontaneously. But in most of our big cities, they just expanded.
Yeah, because you look at, Detroit, Chicago, you know, some of these cities have just, people have been trapped in these, I consider it trapped, maybe they don't feel trapped, but stuck there generation after generation, and the crime and all of that, it just seems like almost impossible to get out of there.
Yeah, I mean, all those cities now have large districts of very nice middle-class African-American housing. But even those neighborhoods have a higher presence of poverty than comparable white neighborhoods do, and usually have higher levels of crime and a variety of other problems. So the difficulty here is that it's hard to get out of what you could call a segregation equilibrium into an integration equilibrium. Places like San Diego and San Antonio and Seattle did it more or less spontaneously, but it probably won't happen spontaneously in most of our other big cities.
How long did it take them, and does it have anything to do with the amount of space they had to expand? I mean, does it have anything to do with how, you know what I mean? Like, some of our big cities have a massive number of people in a very small footprint. But a lot of times, like in California, our big cities have a little bit more room on the edges. Does it have anything to do with that?
Well, it probably helps. I mean, we know that economic growth in the 70s and 80s helped, partly because things were in flux, and you know, when a lot of other changes are going on, it's easier for a change like this to happen. But interestingly, a lot of the southern cities which weren't necessarily any bigger than the northern cities, did have more desegregation in the 70s and 80s and have continued to have somewhat more
because they had this
reverse migration. You had blacks moved in vast numbers from the south to the north in the first half of the 20th century, and then starting around 1970, a lot of urban blacks moved back to the urban south. And when they made those moves, they usually moved to more integrated areas.
Well, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, so a place like Atlanta or Nashville has substantially more integration than Chicago or Detroit or New York. They're still not, you know, they haven't quite hit that critical mass where everything starts really substantially desegregating, but they're a lot closer.
So what do you see policy-wise now? I mean, where are we and where are we headed when you start looking at what we do? Is it mostly national policy or is it things that are statewide?
Well, I'd say at all levels of government. The things that we're doing these days, I think, are not aren't what we need to do. In other words, there's still a lot of focus on housing laws, which I think is great. I mean, discrimination is much, much lower than it was in the 60s, probably a tenth or less of what it was. But, you know, it's still certainly important to fight it where it shows up. There's a lot of a focus on where subsidized housing should be built and located. And that, I think, is kind of a counterproductive investment of energy, because if you have a proposal to put, say, 100 units of subsidized housing into a suburb, that becomes a real flashpoint of controversy. It's sort of the way to maximize political opposition to integration. And I think there are a lot of other strategies we could do that are much more market friendly and based on choice, and yet probably reaching many more people.
What would be an option to that?
So an example are what we call mobility centers. The one part of Chicago that's quite integrated is in a western suburb called Oak Park, which is, it's very close to some very segregated neighborhoods, but it's managed to be extremely integrated because it has a city service that essentially encourages people to come in and get help with planning a move. And the center collects information on lots of housing opportunities, works with, you know, housing agents and so on, and essentially smooths the path for people to consider a wider range of neighborhoods than they might on their own.
Oh, okay.
And fosters pro-integrated moves, encourages, helps whites identify integrated neighborhoods where they'll feel comfortable and find good housing, encourages blacks to move into predominantly white neighborhoods. And through that, Oak Park has just become steadily more integrated. And now it probably doesn't even need that center. It's kind of created its own little integrated metropolis.
People have kind of figured out how to do that. So it isn't a place where people are housed. It's a place where people get help to find housing elsewhere.
Right.
See, because it's true, we see that here. You know, every now and then there is a push to put in low-income housing, and, you know, the people who own homes near there are like, oh, here we go. And they do typically kind of go downhill.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the findings on that differ, and it probably depends on how it's done and so on. But
absolutely.
In any case, it's very expensive per unit, and it sort of makes it sort of highlights all the disadvantages of integration instead of the advantages. So another strategy is to try to insulate some of the housing in the neighborhoods that are going through gentrification. So a lot of times, developers will be interested in investing in new housing in urban cores, as we talked about before. And that often becomes a flashpoint of opposition. You know, just as a white suburb might oppose a public housing development, so an inner-city neighborhood might oppose a developer who wants to build luxury condos. It's sort of the mirror image.
Right, because you do hear about that a lot.
Yeah, and if we can shelter some of the housing in those neighborhoods from that can change people's attitudes about gentrification. Because fundamentally, moving affluent people into cities is going to be good for the city. It's going to be good for the neighborhoods. What people are concerned about is that their housing is going to become unaffordable, and they won't be there to enjoy those benefits. So if you have a trust fund that essentially buys some of these units, puts a restriction on how quickly the rent in that building can go up, and then resell it into the private market, you've got a mechanism for diffusing that neighborhood hostility and making sure that the gentrified neighborhood will still be an integrated one.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, because it goes both ways, you know. There goes the neighborhood, right? Yep. I mean, we have affordable housing, and now we're not going to because all the fancy people showed up.
Well, I think that's the big concern with people is you take a predominantly middle-class neighborhood and move affordable housing in, you're basically moving people in that have a lower social status or lower income level and don't have the same lifestyle as the people that live there currently.
If you do it in big blocks like that.
Yeah, and so
I like your mobility center?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's the way to do it, because then people can go where they want, and you're not hurting people
right.
like cattle, basically.
Yeah.
Which is never a good way to, here, let me help you. get on the bus and we'll take you there. Got to take a really quick break. Our guest today is Richard Sander. We're discussing his book, Moving Toward Integration, The Past and Future of Fair Housing. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
Where do we go from here?
Practicing our night moves, trying to lose the all like Southern Michigan summertime.
I don't know what you think about pink houses, Richard, but, you know, that could be like your theme song for the book.
It's always good to have a theme song.
Yeah, a little pink or whatever color you like houses, you know. You're one of the points here that they had sent us this was kind of an interesting deal, and it's something that, you know, nobody talks about because it's kind of dangerous water to swim in. But it says here, moving toward integration notes that liberals tend to emphasize discrimination and racism as explanations for continued segregation, while conservatives usually accentuate the role of personal preference and self-segregation while making the case against government social engineering. That's so loaded, but I know you can unravel that for us, and we'll just shut
That's
up and let
crux
you talk.
Of the problem right there.
Sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have a very divisive conversation about race in America.
Yes.
You know, part of the problem is that we have these competing worldviews that don't seem to have any overlap at all. And the rhetoric that's used on the left to try to draw attention to racial problems like police shootings and segregation itself really does tend to use this very strong language. And I think when you emphasize racism, it seems to me that you're sort of doing the most counterproductive thing you can do, because on the one hand you're making whites feel very defensive. And on the other hand, your message to blacks is sort of like, well, you know, whites are bad, so why would you want to live around them?
That's true. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, if you try to come up with a really bad strategy, it would seem to me it would be something like that. And conversely, I think it's also fair for liberals to say that arguing that any effort to increase integration is social engineering is a little bit unfair, because there was a lot of social engineering that was increasing segregation during most of the 20th century. So in places that are stuck, where segregation is just not declining in a way that you know that we see in other metropolitan areas, it makes sense to see a role for government in trying to nudge things along. So I think there's a middle ground that that if articulated could attract support across the political spectrum. Because at the end of the day, you know, people, I don't think the right feels that racial inequality is healthy for America in the long term. And I think the left focuses a lot on manifestations of inequality, but has sort of lost its focus on what are fundamental mechanisms, what are fundamental things we could do to reduce inequality.
And how blaming people for things they either didn't cause or can't control isn't really helpful.
Yeah, you know, and it may produce some short-term reforms, but what we really need is a kind of a grand strategy.
I think, I don't know if we touched on this much, but people of all races need opportunity to improve their lives, and I think with the black community, I don't think if given the choice they want to live in low income housing, they want to move up in the world, but you have to be able to give them some opportunity to make more money, to be more successful, to improve their standard of living. And if we don't, you know, do something about giving them that opportunity to improve their own situation,
they can't move out.
They can't move out. I mean, you can put them in any kind of house you want, but if they can't afford to live there, it's going to revert back to what they came from. So don't you feel that you know, employment and education, I think, are two things that are probably big considerations into improving this integration?
Yeah, whether you have options or whether you don't.
Right, exactly.
It really is important, but it's also I want to emphasize something that's often overlooked, which is that we have Although black median income nationally is only about 60% of white median income, there is a lot of overlap between black and white incomes. And there is a lot of heterogeneity in our neighborhoods already in terms of how expensive housing is. You know, we all live in neighborhoods that have more expensive housing, frequently apartments. And there's enough range there that when you measure it, the economic component of segregation only explains about a quarter of what's there.
No kidding.
So what that means is that we can actually make a lot of progress in any metropolitan area towards integration without changing anybody's income. We want those changes to happen as reform proceeds, but we don't need to start by making big income transfers. We can start by just reducing segregation levels down, you know, into that those levels, low 70s and 60s that I talked about before. And then you start these other mechanisms that that further reduce inequality.
So if you could roll into a place, which place did you say was, you know, really hovering at the bottom, like Chicago?
Yeah, Chicago, St. Louis, New York, Milwaukee, all those places are still in the 80s on our 0 to 100 scale.
So if you could roll in to any one of or all of those from a policy standpoint, what would you, you know, what would your changes look like? Like, where would you start? What's the most important thing to either get rid of or add?
Well, it's very important to have a metropolitan level approach because you're really talking about metropolitan integration. You can't do this on a neighborhood by neighborhood level. So you've got to have some sort of cooperative enterprise among the various regional governments. And the second thing is that you articulate this as a goal. You sort of say, you know, we have identified our high level of segregation as a problem, and we're not going to force anyone to move, but we're going to try to see if we can get metropolitan segregation levels down through a variety of nudges and modest programs. So resetting public expectations about what's going on, I think, is a really important thing.
And would you do this with policy, like government policy or private industry? Like, I understand there's a role for private industry, but could this be done just through the private sector, or does it require the government to be? I realize you're going to have to use the government if you're, housing and different things, but how do you see that breakout?
Well, in principle, you could do it all privately, and I think, in terms of a realistic political path to doing this, what might really get things rolling is if a couple of major foundations started initiatives like this in a couple of substantial metropolitan areas. We cost out what it would cost to do in the Buffalo metropolitan area, for example. And it's well within the means of many foundations. It's much less expensive than a lot of existing government programs. But yes, at some point, you want this to become part of government policy. We have a lot of fair housing policies now, and you want those to sort of move towards what we would call a next-generation policy that really focuses on integration.
Instead of just preventing discrimination.
Exactly.
Well, that makes sense. What's the one thing you'd get rid of that's keeping things the way they are that you see?
You want to try to intervene in cycles where resegregation is happening. So the neighborhoods that you're most interested in trying to address are those where racial transition is occurring. And those are the areas where you'd want to sort of reach out first in terms of mobility centers and so on.
And is a mobility center just like an office with people who can, I mean, is
help that kind of direct where?
Yeah, is it like an employment center
where they want to be?
They work on housing?
Yeah, they're going to have expertise in the housing market. They're going to be finding listings. They're going to know contacts that can help smooth the path for a family moving to a neighborhood. They could also, if they were cooperating with local government agencies, they could also have access to housing programs where, you know, we have vouchers that are provided for people who meet eligibility and so on. They could coordinate all that.
So if you were going to, if you lived in a major metropolitan area and you were listening to this and you thought, you know, I really think we should do that, who would you reach out to help you set up a mobility center that works well?
Well, reach out to me. I'm at UCLA, and
well, there you go.
Pretty easy to find on the web. We're putting together a national council of folks who have who've either done research or advocacy in this area, and we're in conversation with possible funders. So the hope is, I mean, the book just came out quite recently, but the hope is over the next year or so we'll actually start building some of the infrastructure for this.
Nice.
Great.
Well, thank you so much. we filled up that hour, and we probably could have gone for a second one. We hope you'll keep us posted on how this is working out for you. Our guest is Richard Sander. His book is Moving Toward Integration, and you can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us. Thanks, Richard.
Good talking to you both.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a great day.
You